welcome to the court. We have one case this morning, United States v. George. Major Golseth, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
I am.
And Captain Washburn, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well then, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. May it please the court. I am Major Samantha Golseth, and I represent the appellant, Senior Airman George. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I'd respectfully request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government must prove every element of the crime charged. The government chose the specification in this case that narrowed the essential element of an overt act to by penetrating her mouth with his penis without her consent. But the government failed to introduce any evidence of the charged overt act. And because it did not prove this overt act that it charged, Senior Airman George's conviction is legally insufficient and must be set aside.
Now, Major Golseth, it's clear from your brief that you believe that there is one and only one way to read that specification, and that is that there was an overt act. Let's say, however, this court were to believe that, in fact, there's some ambiguity in that specification, that you make very good points about why it should be considered an overt act, but the government also makes very good points about why it should be considered a predicate offense. My question to you is, what then? What analytical approach should this court take? What legal principles should we apply? What case law should we point to decide which interpretation is the correct one?
Your Honor, I think the first thing that we need to begin with here is recognizing that the government got to choose the specification in this case and that it has to choose the crime that was charged. And as you mentioned, that we do believe that this specification very clearly sets out what it charges here, which is the what and the how. And I can walk you through why that is, that why this is the plain reading of that specification using...
Well, I'm asking the different question, though.
Yes, sir.
I understand your point from your brief, and I will encourage you to expound upon your view about how you're correct. But what I'm interested in is the scenario I pose to you. If we find ambiguity, what then?
Your Honor, looking there, this court could look potentially to the statutory canons of interpretation. But even then, if we were to look to those, we see the canon, for example, of the rule of the last antecedent, which supports Senior Airman George's reading of the specification. And moreover, ultimately, what I think the government's argument here is that, well, that's not what we intended in the specification, and that doesn't matter because, again, this goes back to the government has to prove what was actually charged, not what the government intended to charge, but what they did charge.
Okay, so let me kind of steer back, though, to the question. Now, in Watkins, which is an older case, and a different scenario really had to do with failure to state an offense, but it was still this court wrestling with how to interpret what the specification actually alleged. There we said that if it is challenged on appeal, after trial, to be more correct, then it should be liberally construed in an effort to prove its validity. Why should this court not take that approach?
For two reasons, Your Honor. First, because the first I'll explain is kind of tied to United States versus Musacchio. And the second is tied, I'd like to talk about English and why that's the more appropriate case to look at here. So first, addressing Watkins directly, the question there was whether the specification stated an offense. And here, Senior Airman George concedes that this specification does state an offense. Moreover, looking to United States versus Musahiyo, that's the Supreme Court case that tells us that ultimately how a case is litigated at trial, what the trial parties believe the elements were, and even what the military judge instructed the elements to be, does not change how this court reviews legal sufficiency. So let's imagine Senior Airman George had objected to this at trial. One of the possible outcomes of that could have been that the military judge would have given different instructions. And following United States versus Musahiyo, we know that that still wouldn't change this court's legal sufficiency review now, because the instructions that are given at trial do not change legal sufficiency review. Because that legal sufficiency review is just looking to what are the elements charged in the offense, and has the government proven those beyond a reasonable doubt, or could a rational trier fact find that they have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Moreover, English is more of an apt case to look at here, because in that case, this court also looked at, well, hang on, what do we mean by the words to wit in this specification? The government alleged that this offense occurred by force or violence, to wit, pushing the individual's head. And so this court similarly in that case looked at, well, what was alleged by to wit there, and ultimately determined that was explaining the how, and that the government had therefore narrowed the specification in that case to how it could prove the act in that case. And the government has similarly done the same here. The government narrowed the specification in this case to proving the overt act by penetrating her mouth with his penis, because when we think about just how reading comprehension works, how we read this specification, the word attempt needs a direct object. So does commit. So we can't just read attempt on its own. We can't read attempt to commit on its own. They each need a direct object. So we keep reading the specification, and we get to a sexual act. A sexual act is the direct object that explains what the attempt was in this case. And that phrase, if you will, the attempt to commit a sexual act, is telling us what the attempt was, and it has to be read and understood together as that phrase. So the modifying language that then follows doesn't just modify a portion of this, it applies to that entire whole phrase to explain how the attempt was done. And it explains how the attempt was done because that's the plain and common usage of the word by, and it's especially when by is paired with a gerund or an ing word.
So can I pull back from the details and ask you an overarching question? And that is, if this court were to agree with you, what would this court's holding be? What if someone is reading this case 5 years from now, saying United States versus George, U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces held that, what is the one sentence they would take away?
That when the government expressly alleges an overt act, it must prove that expressly alleged overt act.
But doesn't that assume that, in fact, it was an overt act? My point is, how does this court determine that you're correct, that it was an overt act rather than a predicate act? There seems to be a step that needs to be taken, some analytical step, to get to the point where we say, you know what, Major Golseth, you're 100% right. That was an overt act.
Because, Your Honor, here, the words by, when paired with an ing word, is telling us how something was achieved, how something was done. And when we look to the Supreme Court precedent in Sion, for example, that can be helpful because that shows us how when modifying language follows a phrase, it doesn't just apply to a part of the phrase, it applies to the entirety of that phrase. So when we look to Sion, for example, that's explaining a type of class action in that case. All of the words that came before were describing the type of class action. And the same is true here, where attempt to commit a sexual act is explaining a type of attempt. That's different than, for example, Barnhart, where that was explaining two separate things. Here, because this is referring to just one thing, our plain and common understanding is that it modifies attempt. And we can see that when we look to similar Article 80 cases, Article 80 cases that have the same grammatical construction. I point this court to the appellant's reply brief at pages 8 and 9. There's a chart there that explains, for example, shows that there's the same grammatical construction that is in this specification in United States versus Norwood, United States versus Payne, United States versus Turner, and United States versus Wheeler. And in each of those cases, what I am explaining to you now can be seen in these cases. So, for example, in United States versus Payne, the individual was accused, the issue was that whether he did attempt to persuade, induce, entice, or coerce Marley to create child pornography. And the bywords that followed were by requesting that Marley send nude photographs of herself to the said Staff Sergeant Payne. There, by requesting that she send nude photographs of herself, was not just create child pornography, it was modifying that entire preceding phrase that explained what the type of attempt was, that she was attempting to persuade, or he was attempting to persuade, induce, entice, or coerce. And this can be seen in each of those cases. It can also be seen when we just think about plain language as we use it and as we read it.
Come at this from a different approach? Does the principle that an accused must have fair notice apply in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, but I would say that Senior Man George's fair notice came from the specification as it was charged. So he was on notice that the overt act that was expressly alleged here was that he must penetrate, that the government had to prove that he penetrated her mouth with his penis. Now, while the trial parties may have overlooked that, that doesn't change that that's what the specification ultimately provided notice.
Now, you say the parties overlooked that. So in this context of fair notice, why doesn't the record reflect that, in fact, the defense had actual notice? And what I'm pointing to there is the fact that there was no motion for a bill of particulars. There was no motion for a failure to state an offense. There was no motion for a finding of not guilty. And importantly, there was no argument to the panel that, hey, members of the panel, you cannot convict. There was a requirement for the government to prove that the appellant's penis actually penetrated the mouth of the victim. As you've heard, ladies and gentlemen of the panel, that never happened. Therefore, you must acquit. That argument, those motions were never made. Why shouldn't that indicate to this court that beyond fair notice, there was actual notice?
Because, Your Honor, sometimes things are missed at the trial level. And really, this footstomps the import of this court's responsibility.
Could it be not just missed at the trial level as compared to sandbagging occur? So that nothing is raised, so that you've got this get-out-of-jail-free card sitting there on appeal, and this court should be concerned about that and perhaps say that there will be a different standard of review by this court or by CCA if it is this type of issue is raised after trial.
No, Your Honor, the court should not apply some different standard of review, and the reason why is because ultimately the government controls the charge sheet. They control how they're going to charge a crime, and they are the ones who are ultimately responsible for proving the crime that it charged. So while defense counsel might have overlooked this as well, more importantly, the government overlooked what it charged. And so the review by this court should not change because similar, again, to Musacchio, if the instructions at trial do not change what this court's review is, then neither should the fact that defense counsel overlooked this. And ultimately, it was the government's responsibility to make sure that when it charged the offense in this case, that it understood what that language was charging, and two, that it could prove what it had charged.
Counsel, may I ask a question? In the model specification for an Article 120 offense, there's the word by. What does that word modify?
Commit a sexual act, Your Honor, because ultimately it's not just telling us that there it was penetration. It's not just in a positive of sexual act on its own. It's modifying commit a sexual act to tell us how that sexual act was done. And so ultimately what happened here is it appears.
So if you can have the by right after the sexual act, it modifies the sexual act, but you're saying that's not the case when you charge it as an attempt. Are you suggesting that they should have said attempted to commit a sexual act? How could they follow that language and use the word by without running afoul of your argument that it's alleging an overt act? How could they do that? How could they specify the charge so that it followed the language of the Part 4 of the manual without alleging an overt act?
So a few things there, Your Honor. First, I would say the government did not have to allege the elements that were in the model specification. Because this was an attempt offense, they only needed to provide the nature of the underlying act and did not have to essentially plug in the Article 120 sample specification into the attempt offense. To be clear, my argument is that when by follows, especially when it's paired with an ing word, in Article 120 even, it wouldn't just be modifying a sexual act, it would be modifying commit a sexual act, because that would be the unified phrase that comes before it. And here, the government essentially overlooked that the same was true when attempt was now a part of this phrase that came before it. And the government is basically asking us to jump to the end of the specification, read that as attempt to commit sexual assault without consent, and then come back forward and apply attempt. But that's not how reading comprehension works. We understand the unified phrase first, and that unified phrase gets modified by the language that follows.
Doesn't it seem a little odd that you're saying that's the plain language of the statute, but neither the parties, nor the military judge, nor the three judges on the Court of Appeals for the Air Force Court thought that that was the plain meaning?
Your Honor, I don't think the Air Force Court actually read into what was alleged in the specification. They ultimately just found that there was notice. And the specification here, like in English, is clear because it tells us how this was done. Your Honor, I see my time is running.
I'm trying to get to the logical conclusion of your argument. Are you saying that if the specification had just dropped the by penetrating her mouth with his penis without her consent, that the government would have been on better legal grounds? Because then they would have not defined the overt act?
Yes, Your Honor, and because, again, this is kind of like we're taking United States versus English, where there the government narrowed the specification, and in that case, this court's holding was based in part on the notice that was taken at trial, but it wasn't solely based on that. In English, this court explained that ultimately it was the charging of the specification that the government had to meet. And here, when the government put Senior Airman George on notice of this through the charge language of the specification, when they said this is how the overt act has happened, that was the only way that the government could prove this. And there were no exceptions or substitutions at trial. So to affirm this on appeal would mean that we are finding that a broader or different theory would apply than what was charged in the specification.
Further questions?
I do have one, Chief, if you'll indulge me.
Absolutely.
Major Goldsmith, now, isn't there a logic problem if you want to read the specification the way you're suggesting? And I guess the prepositional phrase stuff aside, I wasn't an English major. I was actually an engineering major. But that said, it seems like if we were to read the specification as you are suggesting, then the military judge would have had to instruct the members that the accused is charged with attempting the offense of sexual assault by committing the overt act of the completed sexual assault. I mean, isn't that probably some of the reason why the party said, well, look, that you can't read it like that because it's kind of an absurd reading? And they read it otherwise, and that's why there's no objection. That's why there's no objection to the military judge's rulings, and maybe that's why the CCA read it that way.
I think, Your Honor, that's a problem with how the government charged it, but it doesn't ultimately change what the government charged. So I agree with
you. But I guess what I'm saying is that if that's how the parties read it, it seemed that someone would have objected to that.
And I agree with you, Your Honor, that I think this was overlooked at trial, and perhaps for the reason that you've suggested. But the government here, ultimately, we're looking at have they, or the issue that was kind of raised by the government is does this ultimately state an offense if there is a completed act there, and can these two things be logical together? And the answer is that this specification does state each element of the offense. And ultimately, the issue would just be whether the government could prove that, which is conflating its ability to prove what it is charged vice whether it has actually charged a crime here and what it did charge. So here it did charge that this was an attempt to commit a sexual act and that the overt act here was penetrating her mouth with his penis without her consent. And
but that's the actual completed offense that he's charged with attempting.
Yes, Your Honor, but the plain language here tells us that the by is modifying attempt to commit a sexual act to tell us how the attempt was done. And in every other scenario where we see that, by is by penetrating, by requesting, by means of shooting. Each time we're putting this with an ing word, it's telling us this is how this was done. And I don't want to belabor the point because I know I'm over time here, but I would just point this court to JA at 89 to see the Air Force Court's opinion there at footnote 5, where you can see there the Air Force Court, using the same grammatical construction as they explained, failed to state an offense by omitting a necessary element. Thereby omitting a necessary element would not just modify offense, it would not just modify state an offense, it would modify failed to state an offense. And the same is true here. So even though these things may have made it so that the government could not prove their case, that's the risk that the government took on when they chose how they were charging this specification, and they must have proved each of the elements as they charged them.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Major Golsa. Captain Washburn.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Tyler Washburn, and along with Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represent the United States. This court should find appellant's conviction is legally sufficient because the specification did not allege an overt act, no one at the trial level believed that it did, and the government proved two overt acts sufficient to establish appellant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Before I launch into my outline, I do want to answer a question that this court asked the appellant. What legal standards should this court use in assessing this specification? This court should not adopt appellant's argument that you should use the canons of statutory interpretation, because here we're not interpreting a statute. What we're doing is interpreting the meaning of a specification. This court, while Watkins is not directly on point, it is the closest corollary that this court has to this situation, in which the court was evaluating, as you noted, Your Honor, the sufficiency of a specification. That's functionally what we're doing here. And so in doing so, this court should afford great deference to what happened at the trial level.
So, counsel, on that point, so if the question was specifically the one that Chief Judge asked previously, which is if a specification is subject to more than one reasonable meaning, are arguably subject to more reasonable meaning, this court should prefer the meaning that was adopted at trial. Is that the rule you're stating?
Well, Your Honor, not exactly. I think the Watkins precedent stands for the ultimate conclusion or the ultimate point that this court should construe with maximum liberality the specification to, in order to determine whether there's a reasonable construction that ultimately results in that specification being either legally sufficient in the case of Watkins or in this case stating a defense, and where the trial level has adopted an interpretation in which all parties proceeded and it was very clear what the parties understood the specification to mean, when viewing with maximum liberality, the short court should construe it in that manner, and that the court can use what happened at the trial level as evidence of the reasonable construction of the government's interpretation vice the appellant's interpretation of the specification. As I already stated, at trial, all parties understood that the government had not charged an overt act. At no point did the appellant's defense counsel request a bill of particulars indicating that they didn't understand or that they wanted additional notice of what the overt act was. They never filed a ninth.
Captain, you have to admit, though, it's kind of an odd way to charge an attempt, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I would actually respectfully disagree that it's an odd way to charge an
attempt. Well, you don't have to be respectfully disagreeing. You can just disagree.
Well, with deference, Your Honor. Well, if you look, Your Honor, at the model specifications for Article 80 and the model specifications for Article 120, it becomes apparent what occurred here. If you look at Article 80, the directive from the model specification in Article 80 states that the government did attempt to, and then the government should describe the offense with sufficient detail to include expressly or by necessary implication every element. What happened here was the government simply expressly listed every necessary element, and they did so by importing the Article 120 model specification into Article 80. And to your point from appellant's argument, Your Honor, that is where the by language first appears, is in the Article 120 specification. So when appellant is arguing that this court should look to Cyan and that this is a unified phrase, that's not the case. Here we have two separate clauses. The did attempt to, stemming from the Article 80 model specification, and then the by penetrating victim's mouth with his penis without her consent, which comes from the Article 120. So they're not a unified phrase. They just are juxtaposed and imported together in an Article 80 specification. So, no, Your Honor, I don't think it's an odd way to do it. I think it's exactly how the manual dictates that it should be charged in attempt cases.
Counsel, on that point, counsel for appellant in the brief has listed a number of previous cases in which the words following the by was an allegation of the overt act. Do you have any case in which the word by was used and it didn't allege an overt act in an attempt case? Because, I mean, I can see how you put the two things together, but we're trying to read it the most reasonable way, and there are a lot of cases where the word after by is an allegation of the overt act. Is there any case where the words after the by was not part of, was not alleging an overt act, but was instead alleging part of the predicate offense or the underlying offense?
Not a case, Your Honor, but a point of legal analysis in reading each and every case that's cited by the appellant. If we want to use Norwood as an example. So if looking at Norwood, the language that followed the by clearly articulated an incomplete offense or a substantial step towards the completion of the offense. And that's how this specification is different than all of the cases.
But correct me if I'm wrong. Doesn't Norwood use the word trying?
It does, Your Honor, and I think
isn't that a very important distinction between Norwood and this case?
I would agree, Your Honor, but that trying is important because the use of the word trying is what demonstrates that the specification in Norwood is articulating a substantial step short of the completed predicate offense, whereas here, because the government did not use the word trying, what the government articulated was the underlying predicate offense. And if you look at the other cases cited by the appellant, they all follow in a similar vein in that they're all very clearly articulating a step short of the completed predicate offense, whereas here it is clear that the government articulated the predicate offense in a situation where we're charging an inchoate offense, which by its very nature is incomplete. But more importantly, I think it's relevant to this Court's analysis to consider the common sense perspective. The appellant argues that it's common sense and it's just the logical grammatical reading to interpret by, to be modifying, attempt to. But if it was so common sense, why at the trial level did the parties not adopt appellant's interpretation? And that's because it's against common sense. If it would be an odd world, Your Honors, where the government, knowing that it can prove murder in the first degree, charged attempted murder. It just doesn't logically, it just doesn't make sense to charge it in such a way.
But why shouldn't we revert to first principles? And what I mean by that is, fundamental principle is an accused is supposed to be given fair notice of what they need to defend against. You've got the government who's holding the pen. The government determines what that language is. When we're having to get into all these grammatical rules, for instance, in your own brief, you invoke what the defense correctly refers to as the last antecedent rule, and you say a prepositional phrase with an adverbial or adjectival function should be close to the word it modifies to avoid awkwardness, ambiguity, or unintended meanings. And you read that, and you say, what? I mean, even Washington Post columnist George Will doesn't talk that way. And so when you've got a junior enlisted member who is reading what the government has prepared and trying to understand what's going on, why shouldn't the burden squarely and solely be on the government to provide language that is plain and clear so that the accused has fair notice?
Well, Your Honor, in this particular case, the accused did have fair notice, and that's evident from the conduct of his defense counsel at trial, that they never cross-examined any of the witnesses about whether actual penetration occurred. They had the opportunity to request an instruction that the government was required to prove penetration occurred. They did not. They had the opportunity to argue that in closing. They did not. They had the opportunity to object when the government articulated two specific overt acts that they believed.
So what if, in a hypothetical situation, we had a specification that very clearly, very plainly, says A, but all the parties in the courtroom definitively understood at noon that demonstrated that they knew that it meant B. Would this court then have to say, we're not going to pay attention to the very clear language. We are going to be controlled simply by what we can intuit was understood within the courtroom?
Well, I think, Your Honor, I think that that would hearken back to the Watkins test. And was there a reasonable construction, and was the construction that was adopted at trial a reasonable one? In your hypothetical, Your Honor, it sounds like it wasn't. And under Watkins and the guidance provided in Watkins, this Court would find that that was insufficient. But here, where there is a reasonable construction of the specification that is also adopted by the parties at trial, adopted by the military judge and then adopted by the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals at the appellate level, that should be a strong indication to this Court, and this Court should be reluctant to second-guess the trial level where there is a reasonable construction that was adopted at trial. It also, to hold otherwise, Your Honor, would set a very dangerous precedent because it would encourage, as Your Honor put it earlier, sandbagging at the trial level. It would encourage appellants to litigate the case at the trial level under one particular theory, and then once they've lost, to then cry foul on appeal. And this court should not incentivize appellants to engage in that behavior. This is an issue that should be raised most appropriately at the trial level, where it can be addressed by the military judge, whether it be through instructions, whether it be through motions, because there is so much reliance on the particular interpretation at hand. And here...
So I suppose turnabout is fair play, so let me ask you. If we were to author an opinion that is consistent with your position, what is the holding? What is the takeaway? What is the nub of this that would be in that keynote about what our holding is here?
Well, Your Honor, the ultimate holding in this court should be that where the government utilizes or follows the model specifications and comports with the model specifications in the manual for courts martial, and that when they're charging an attempt, they describe the offense with sufficient detail to include expressly every element of the predicate offense, that is sufficient for this court's purposes. That does provide, as Your Honor noted, fair notice to the appellant of what he's accused of. It provides ample protections against double jeopardy. I'd like to address a point that appellant's counsel made, that if the government had merely...
So it sounds like for your holding, you're looking for something that is extremely narrowly tailored to the facts of this case rather than a broader principle of law.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I think that...
So what is the broader principle of law? I'm trying to distill from your response that broader principle of law.
Well, Your Honor, I think the broader principle is just that in charging an attempt, when the government's articulating the underlying predicate offense, that the government can and should charge with specificity because it does provide notice and it does provide adequate protections against double jeopardy. And ultimately, I think that would be a very broad-reaching opinion, and I think it would have an impact on the field in the sense that it would give the field confidence in the model specifications as contained in the manual for courts martial.
Counsel, I want to follow up on something that was in your answer to the chief. I think the government argues forcing your brief, and I think you just mentioned that the government doesn't have to allege the overt act, right? It's just enough to say attempt predicate offense. And I think you're relying on Norwood and Marshall for that principle. And in Marshall, you just referenced the two limitations Marshall puts on this, right? There are two requirements. The accused has to have fair notice and the accused has to be protected from double jeopardy. So I'm curious about the double jeopardy prong here. If the overt act is not included in the specification, does it include then by implication all overt acts that might have occurred in terms of double jeopardy? Like say, this is not this case, but you can imagine a case where maybe, an accused first tries to forcibly, move the victim and then threatens the victim with violence, right? Those would be two different overt acts to try and commit the offense. Is the government then saying if we don't allege it in the specification, then the accused would be protected from all different overt acts that might be implied by the fact that the government didn't include any particular overt act in the specification?
Yes, Your Honor. In some ways, not charging the specific overt act offers more protection than charging a specific overt act. If you look at a plain language, a strict Blockberger test, alleging one overt act and then alleging another, those overt acts are separate and distinct elements that the government could potentially proceed to at trial. But where the government does not specifically allege a specific overt act, in that particular case, any overt acts that are introduced as part of the overall transaction, they're all part and parcel to this, the same transaction, that would provide protections against those for purposes of double jeopardy. The Supreme Court, if I may, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court has noted in the past that in an attempt case, specifically Resendez-Ponce, that the sort of unity of the plan is all-encompassed. So where there's multiple overt acts alleged, they can be an appellant can be convicted for either. It does not — federal law does not require that the members agree. But that same principle would apply to your question in terms of double jeopardy. Because he could be convicted for any of the overt offenses or acts alleged or proved at trial, he would thereby be protected from those for purposes of double jeopardy.
And later in Marshall, the court, our professor went on to say, if more particularity is deemed desirable by the accused, he can obtain the details by appropriate preliminary motion or through inquiry in the Article 32 investigation. So that didn't happen here. What should we take from? Does this put us in a forfeiture stance? Does this put us in a waiver stance? What should we read, if anything, into this language in Marshall?
Well, at a bare minimum, Your Honor, I'd say that it puts us at least at forfeiture because they did have the opportunity to do so and they failed. What I suspect, and if I may speculate, Your Honor, what happened was the defense received the discovery and that they, when they perused the discovery, it was clear and apparent on its face that what was going to be introduced at trial was what was introduced at trial. The appellant unzipped his pants and then repeatedly attempted to force the victim's head towards his penis. And those are the two overt acts that were introduced at trial. They were the two overt acts that were argued by the government trial counsel in their closing statement. And they're the two overt acts that are sufficient to sustain appellant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt for purposes of legal sufficiency. Turning next to the ultimate, if I may have one moment, Your Honor. Again, the court should be cautious in this particular case about the message that it's going to send to the field. I know Your Honor cares deeply about what the holding and what the overall impact on the military justice system will be, but adopting appellant's interpretation where it was raised for the first time on appeal and was not shared by any of the parties at the trial level doesn't make sense, and it sends a message to the field that appellants can sit by at the trial level and potentially either sandbag at the appellate level or, when they're rightfully convicted, as in this case, can cry foul at the appellate level, dig through their high school grammar books, and argue that, you know, you can interpret this word differently than what everyone, you know, two trained attorneys, a military judge, and a government attorney believed at trial, different than what the, Air Force appellate court believed at trial. So this court should decline appellant's invitation to adopt an interpretation of the specification on appeal that none of the parties adopted at the trial level. This court should find that the government did not allege an overt act, but did prove two overt acts sufficient to establish appellant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Thus, appellant's conviction is legally sufficient.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Washburn.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Major?
The first thing I want to foot stomp is that the government is professed that this is going to send a bad message to the field. But the reality is that the message it sends to the field is to take caution in what the government decides to put in a specification, because it gets to choose that specification, and it is responsible for proving the specification that it charges. And I want to also point back to the military judge's instructions in this case, because it wasn't all that clear. The military judge's instructions are even quite confusing, because the military judge essentially plugged the entire specification in when he explained what the overt act was. So he said, to complete an overt act in this case, you have to have attempted to commit a sexual act by penetrating. The entire specification is what the military judge said the overt act was. Moreover, if this had been raised at trial, this goes back to, okay, that might have changed the instructions, but had the instructions been different at trial, that still wouldn't change what this court's review is now. And so this court should look to In re Winship, Davis, Apprendi, our Supreme Court cases that tell us the government is responsible for what they charge, and they must prove the elements of what is in the specification, not what is in the discovery, not what the parties get confused by at trial, but what is in the specification
that
the government charges.
That seems to be the issue in the disagreement in the case about what it is the government charged. And the Chief Judge started by asking you that if a specification can be read in more than one reasonable way, how do we choose on appeal what which are those reasonable ways we choose it. And I think your response was largely, well, this one can't really be read in more than one reasonable way. It's our way, which I understand your position. The government, however, seemed to have a different view, which is if it can be read in more than one different way, then we follow our precedent to use maximum liberality. I'm not really sure exactly what that would entail, but what is your response to the government on that particular point?
Ultimately, in applying a Watkins test, for example, the question is going to be, does the offense state an offense?
Well, okay. Watkins is not really on point. Watkins is not really on point.
Right.
Let's suppose that we have a specification that can be read in two different ways. Both ways would state an offense. But we're trying to decide how to read it here. It could, you know, we can't bring in parallel evidence because that's not permitted. Do we read it the way it was read at trial? Do we read it according to lenity for the accused? You know, I mean, I think we're struggling here because there's two good arguments on how to read this language, and we're trying to figure out what the rule is on which way we read it. And Watkins doesn't really help us because Watkins says, well, if it could state an offense or not state an offense, we read it maximum liberality to state an offense. But if we can read it both ways to state an offense, which one do we choose?
Your Honor, I think this goes back to ultimately if the instructions at trial hadn't changed, that wouldn't change this court's review. This court has the power to assess and look for what a rational trier of fact could find here, and that has to go to the plain language. And ultimately, if that is ambiguous in any way, then the rule of lenity should apply, and it should be viewed here as Senior McGeorge has put forward.
But counsel, I just want to rewind back then, because this gets back to what Judge Maggs was talking about. We're looking at the essential elements of the offense. So is it your position that we should be looking just purely at the specification, or are the essential elements of the offense defined in the UCMJ in the manual and as explained in the manual?
Your Honor, based on United States versus Roderick, United States versus Weymouth, that explains that in military courts, we don't just look to the statute, we look to the statute and the specification, because the specification tells us how the elements have been alleged. That's similar to how this court reviewed United States versus English, explaining that there, it was the government had narrowed the element of force or violence there to the specific act that followed the two-wit in that case. And so here it's not just a question of has the government proved some other overt act, it's has it proved the overt act that, excuse me, it narrowed itself to in this specification.
Okay. I just wanted to be clear that that's what your argument was. Okay.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Major Gilsa. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
Court is adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.